From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Our national monuments on the chopping block. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. Teddy Roosevelt's legacy of 400 national parks may be America's best idea, but some two dozen national monuments are another matter. Miners, loggers, and some residents in western states are angry that past presidents limited use of millions of acres of public land. President Trump says Clinton, Bush, and Obama abused their power, and he's reportedly ready to shrink the size of some protected areas if he can. We'll hear about disputes, including industrial and recreational interests, environmentalists, and Native American tribes. Also today, residents of Corpus Christi hunkering down or evacuating for Hurricane Harvey. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. President Trump has stirred controversy in the western states by taking aim at national monuments protected by former presidents. As he looks at recommendations that he shrink them in size, does he have the legal power? Later on today's Talking Point, at the U.S. Embassy in Havana, are sonic waves caused by eavesdropping responsible for hearing loss, even brain damage? First, this news update. Despite reports that he's not paying attention, President Trump has tweeted that he is closely monitoring Hurricane Harvey as it heads toward Texas, saying he is here to assist as needed. Forecasters are warning of 120-mile-an-hour winds and historic amounts of rain measured in feet rather than inches. Here's Joe McComb. He's the mayor of Corpus Christi.
The water is going to be the issue. You combine this much rain and a storm surge. We've never had anything like this. So this is, I guess this is one time we really hope the weatherman is wrong. But we're planning for them being right. And so we're telling them that they need to evacuate these low-lying areas, get to higher ground, because, you know, the preservation of life is our number one objective.
Lynn Brzozowski is in Corpus Christi. She's a reporter for the San Antonio Express News. Lynn, thanks a lot for joining our program.
Hi, how are you?
What are you finding in Corpus Christi? Are people paying attention to the kind of warning we just heard from the mayor?
Yeah, they most certainly are. We are right now outside a staging area at the municipal gym where they have charter buses lined up. I'm not sure how many have gone. I'm going to guess about 20 since last night. But we're seeing folks lined up with their pets, their families, their whatever they could get together. For a lot of them, it's kind of a last-minute decision this morning. They just kind of looked at the weather report and said, you know, we need to get out of here. There's no safe ground. We're probably going to lose power. We're probably going to be flooded. Right now, they're taking them about 200 miles inland to San Antonio. It could be pretty messy there as well, but they feel a little bit safer just going somewhere.
Charter buses, are they resorting to those because the roads are so crowded?
I think they're resorting to those because they need to... These are charter buses through a city agency. They need to have a way to move the most people the most expediently. I think they did use some school buses, but right now this is what we're seeing.
So people aren't using their own cars then. Are they leaving them behind?
They're leaving them behind. They're pulling in saying, you know, this car's not going to make it. I don't know if any of our audience members have ever been on the flash flood situation. If you don't have a high clearance, you could get surrounded by water pretty fast. It's pretty scary, pretty dangerous.
So Corpus Christi is a pretty low-lying town.
It's low-lying. Pretty much the whole region is low-lying. We have a lot of outlying resort areas. I wouldn't say resort, more kind of like fishing vacation areas. It's pretty likely that the causeways and the roadways out there are going to get flooded by water and they're going to be cut off. We went to one area that was being evacuated, Port Aransas, yesterday, and residents said you know, they were told that they were going to shut off the power at 6 o'clock. So that's a big incentive in itself to get out of town. You're not going to have any power or any electricity. It's going to be pretty warm out here. So there's really no reason for them to stay. And plus, they are talking about historic storm surges, you know, 10 feet, 12 feet. And as I just heard the mayor say, they're talking about some areas getting 30 inches or more of rain. That's a lot of water on top of storm surge.
So this is like nothing that has been experienced before in Corpus Christi, I take it. You're at a staging area, you said, where they're getting the charter buses ready. Are people persuaded that there is enough being done, that enough preparations have been made?
That's a hard call. That stuff's usually all in retrospect. I know we went to an area where people were online to get sandbags, and some of them had been online in their cars 5-6 hours, and they were fuming. I said, "Why is there only one place to get sand?" But that's a decision made on the emergency management level. But I just spoke to one of the fire marshals who was assisting the evacuation. He said, "You know, we have these drills every June, and finally, it's not a drill anymore. This is what we prepare for." So I think they're doing the best they can. Every storm is different. So many times we have a cone that's looking like it's going to hit us square on, and then at the last minute it breaks up or it veers, it heads north-south. It's really hard to call it.
What about yourself? How long are you going to stay in Corpus Christi?
Well, I'm teamed with a photographer, and we don't know. We have a motel. It's on the interstate, but the owners told us we don't have a backup generator. We're not taking reservations much longer. It's pretty much going to be, we think the power is going to go out. It's going to be dark, but you'll be able to get in your rooms. We don't know if we're going to be able to get around too much reporting if the roads are flooded. So we're kind of playing it by ear. There's really nowhere we can go inland that's going to be safe. The cone's pretty wide.
You might have to go back on one of those charter buses.
I don't know. They won't have charter buses after this afternoon. This is kind of the last call. They said we would be accepting people till noon. It's already 1 o'clock our time, and they're still loading people up. But I don't think that's going to be an option for us. But we do have SUV, so
we're all right. Well, good luck. Good luck to you and all the other people in Corpus Christi. We'll see what happens.
Thank
Lynn Brzozowski, again, reporter for the San Antonio Express News, covering Hurricane Harvey in Corpus Christi. Once again, many thanks. In a moment, our national monuments on the chopping block. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Former Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama all declared vast acreage in the western states protected with national monument status. In April, President Trump pointed in a different direction.
Today I'm signing a new executive order to end another egregious abuse of federal power and to give that power back to the states and to the people where it belongs. The previous administration used a 100-year-old law known as the Antiquities Act to unilaterally put millions of acres of land and water under strict federal control.
Now, pursuant to the president's request, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke studied some 27 protected areas. Yesterday, he reportedly recommended reducing the size of several. Daryl Fears is environmental reporter with the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Which areas, which monuments, as we call them, are the most likely to be shrunk in size if the president finds that he has the power to do it?
Well, I have to start by saying we really don't know. I mean, we know what we've reported, we know that what we've been able to determine through sources at the White House. But to be absolutely certain, we would have to have the document in hand, which we don't have. But to answer your question, as far as what we know, Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase Escalante, both in Utah, are highly controversial, and they were certainly what Trump had in mind when he said egregious use of power and giving back to the people, which seemed to be pretty predetermined as far as what the secretary was going to do. But those two are, you know, pretty much at the center of the debate. And then there's another in California and Oregon, and that is I'm gonna mess this name up. Siskiyou.
Siskiyou.
Exactly. In Northern California, Oregon. And so those three are what we reported as part of the several. Others are saying that there are even more, but we don't know what they are. And frankly, I don't think that the others know what they are either. They just know what people are telling them.
Siskiyou, a Native American tribe long ago in California. It's the name of a county in this state as well, one of 58 counties. So it's familiar to people in California. Daryl Fears again with The Washington Post. Sharon Buccino is director of the Land and Wildlife Program at the National Resources Defense Council. Welcome to you.
It's great to be here.
Let's talk specifically about Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. It's my understanding that the people in Utah were the ones who petitioned the president to take monument status away from those, or at least to shrink them in size. What's wrong with that?
Well, it's a small vocal minority that is opposing the monuments there. Grand Staircase has been in existence for a little while now, and actually you have the local businesses there have seen it as a very good thing for the bottom line, and even the Chamber of Commerce has supported the retaining in its entirety in its current status, Grand Staircase Escalante. The significance of Bears Ears is for the first time we are looking to tap into the wisdom and experience of the Native Americans in managing that land. In my mind, those folks are as much and one of the most powerful local voices that we should be listening to.
Are they divided?
There are a few individuals who have spoken out against Bears Ears Monument, but the proposal came from an intertribal council. The council's made up of representatives of the tribal governments, and that is the proposal that was brought to President Obama. It was debated. Secretary Jewell went out there, held a public hearing for hours, listened to public comment in Bluff, Utah, and it was a result of that extensive process that the monument was designated at the end of the last administration.
Let me go back to Daryl Fears and this administration, the Trump administration. Is the secrecy unusual? The report has been made by the Secretary of the Interior. You've managed to hear about a few possibilities, but we don't know yet what exactly the president wants to do. Clearly, though, from the statement with that we heard, he's going to take some action.
It's highly unusual, Warren, especially when the president's executive order said that this was to be a final report by the secretary. And we read that again and again yesterday to determine if it was correct. And when we talked to the White House about releasing this report, they said it's not a final report. It was a draft. And it clearly states in the executive order that it was to be a final report 120 days after the executive order was signed. We write, even if it were a draft, we write stories. We've written thousands of stories about drafts that have been written, draft reports that have been written, and we write about those reports when they're final. And so this is, I wouldn't say it's unprecedented, but it's highly unusual.
Let me introduce Nick Loras. He's a Heritage Foundation Fellow in Energy and Environmental Policy. Good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're in favor of shrinking the size of these monuments, shrinking government in general. But what about this secrecy? Why do you think that they're not being more forthcoming about what they intend to do?
Well, I think they will be. It just needs to go through the formal process of submitting it to the White House. And it's not necessarily that I disagree or agree with the process. I think this is an open and honest debate that we should have about national monument designations broadly. I think what you've seen in the past is both Republican and Democrat administrations, particularly the G.W. Bush administration and the Obama administration, used this to unilaterally designate large swaths of land and water, restricting land use areas. And because it's done unilaterally, you've had both concerns about President Obama doing this and President Trump potentially shrinking this. And
what about what we just heard from Sharon Buccino about the lengthy process that they went through with the Secretary of Interior going out there and talking to the Native Americans, and now with the local business and Chamber of Commerce people advocating that they retain their status?
Yeah, well, every rulemaking and regulation and designation goes through that. But it still doesn't go through any type of congressional approval. It doesn't go through approval of the people who live there. And if you look at the Navajo tribe of San Juan County, the county in which Bear's Ears resides, they rescinded their report for the monument designation, which tells me that the people who actually live there didn't want this, and they know how to better protect their land than any type of federal designation would do. And in some instances, it will reduce their ability to use their land as they best see fit. So you can have as much discussion with Western governors and county commissioners as much as you want, but if they don't actually have a say in the final decision, I think some sort of congressional legislation needs to occur to reform the Antiquities Act so that the president doesn't have the ability to unilaterally and arbitrarily declare national monuments and take away both economic and environmental decisions from state and local organizations.
Okay, we're going to talk about the Antiquities Act at length, but first, before we do anything else, let me go back to Darrell Fears. What are the restrictions exactly on this land? What can you do, what can't you do on a national monument?
Well, it varies depending on the monument, but some monuments allow cattle grazing, and some allow a lot of entrance into the land by visitors. Some allow other uses. It's really hard to say unless you go monument by monument.
What about Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante? Are they good for mining, for example?
Not that I'm aware, not mining. One of the issues with Grand Staircase Escalante, and I learned this when I talked to cattlemen and politicians in the area, is that much of the monument is closed to protect antiquities and other lands, and is very restrictive there, according to some, because you can't, for example, visitors can't walk in part of the monument. The local leaders want to hold a marathon there, and you can't have a competitive competition in there, and so they have to run on the outskirts of it. And there are grazing rights in Grand Staircase. If you held a permit before the monument designation, you are allowed to graze cattle there, but there are restrictions.
Sharon Buccino, back to you with the National Resources Defense Council. Why can't people walk on these lands? And what about holding a marathon? Why shouldn't there be any competition there?
So a couple things. One is people can walk on them, and part of the purpose in setting aside Take Bear's Ears as a monument was to ensure that all of us, both today and tomorrow, get to continue to enjoy these lands. And because there were imminent threats to those lands, it's about restricting uses that monopolize and destroy the ability of all of us to enjoy them. And it's a critical distinction that I want to make in terms of there is no prohibition on existing uses. A monument declaration does not seek to grab or change any way any existing rights, whether it's mining, drilling, or grazing. It does change the legal framework going forward, but it is just the beginning of a public management process. And what frustrates me the most with this review is we seem to be stuck on whether or not these monuments should exist, and we haven't done anything.
Well, what are the threats that you see?
Drilling, mining, looting, and we need Zinke and President Trump owe us more than just doing nothing. They owe us putting the time and money into preserving these treasures and the monuments for all of us to enjoy and for our children to enjoy as well.
Nick Lawrence with the Heritage Foundation. Drilling, mining, looting of antiquities. What about that? Are those appropriate in those areas? And shouldn't the antiquities particularly be protected?
I think it depends on the area. I mean, we're not necessarily talking about drilling in Yosemite, but there are large swaths of land where there aren't a lot of tourists or recreational purposes. But with new monument proclamations, those activities are put off use, including renewable energy. It's not just mining for oil and gas or coal or uranium. It's also, solar, wind, geothermal leases that are potentially put off limits too. And I think what this really does is take away opportunities for those multiple land use opportunities where communities can come together and decide, what should the right balance of grazing, timber harvesting, commercial fishing, mineral extraction, and all those alternative forms of outdoor recreation that Western states typically enjoy. Let's put those decisions in the hands of the local communities who have protected these resources and the precious areas that we've had for so long. I mean, Bears Ears wasn't a national monument, and it's been doing quite well. I don't think there's any imminent threat to looting or oil extraction, anything like that, that threatens that area, especially when the native tribes want to take care of that land and preserve it for the people of the future.
Daryl Fairs with the Washington Post. How much of a disagreement do you find in the area of Bears Ears? We're talking about Bears Ears and also the Grand Staircase Escalante, both of them in the state of Utah. The state was one that asked the federal government to back off of the monument status and reduce the status considerably.
Right. There is considerable agreement around Bears Ears. I did a lot of reporting around Bears Ears. I didn't do much around Grand Staircase Escalante. When you talk to Native tribes in Bears Ears, they say that there had been significant looting and desecration of some of the sites by visitors who entered Bears Ears before it became a monument. So I would dispute, at least I think Native tribes would dispute, that there hasn't been any problem with looting.
How do they feel about the idea of renewable energy, wind and geothermal uses?
I have to say, I didn't discuss that particularly with them. They were very concerned about any uses that weren't native uses on that land. They were primarily concerned with anything that might infringe on their tribal territory, their tribal rights, and their tribal traditions.
So you then saw the tribes, I take it, are in favor of maintaining, despite the fact that this one tribe, San Juan County Navajo, felt differently. Did you find that as well?
Sure, yeah. I think that there is a split among the Aneth, the San Juan tribes are called the Aneth tribe of the Navajo. And there was a distinction there, but even the Aneth are split whether they favor the tribe or not. But I think that the four tribe coalition that favored the monument, there is an overwhelming majority there.
Daryl Fairs with the Washington Post, thanks for having joined us. We appreciate it. We'll continue this conversation with our other guests. And at the end of our program, our talking point, the U.S. Embassy in Havana, are sonic waves caused by eavesdropping responsible for hearing loss? We'll talk about that, even brain damage. This is To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled.
This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To the Point, talking about the controversy caused by President Trump, who has said that President Obama particularly, but other presidents as well, have been guilty of an egregious abuse of federal power by increasing the size of some national monuments and creating some new national monuments in areas such as Utah, where both Bear's Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante are located. Now, the Secretary of the Interior has made a report, still not revealed publicly, about what might be done, and it is thought that he is recommending that both of those places and others as well be reduced in size using the Antiquities Act passed 100 years ago. Mark Squillace is a professor of natural resources law at the University of Colorado Law School. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much.
What about the use of the Antiquities Act? It goes back to the era of Teddy Roosevelt, as we heard earlier.
Right. So interesting law, and the interesting legal question that we're likely to confront in the near future is whether or not the president has the authority to change or modify any of the monuments that have previously been designated by other presidents. And I would take the position that the president does not have that authority.
Why not? If the president can create it, why can't the president eliminate or modify it?
Yeah, that's the, sort of the argument, the basic argument on the other side. But let me run this, run you through this. It starts with the property clause of the U.S. Constitution, which grants to the Congress the plenary authority or the comprehensive authority to regulate all of our public lands. Now, the Congress can delegate that authority to the executive branch, but those delegations are limited by their terms. When Congress enacted the 1906 Antiquities Act, it allowed the president to reserve lands. But there were two contemporaneous laws that were passed on either side of the Antiquities Act, the Forest Service Organic Administration Act of 1897 and the Pickett Act of 1910. And in both of those statutes, which authorized similar types of reservations or withdrawals, Congress explicitly included the authority to modify or revoke those kinds of withdrawals. So the argument essentially is that when Congress limited the delegation to reserving lands, it specifically intended to limit the president's authority and did not allow the revocation or modification of those withdrawals.
Nick Loris, still with us, Heritage Foundation Fellow in Energy and Environmental Policy. I believe you said earlier in the program that Congress ought to change the law. Are you conceding the argument then that Mark Squillace is making?
I don't know. Honestly, I'm not a legal expert. I do know that there have been past examples of national monument reductions. Eisenhower, Truman, Taft, Wilson, Coolidge, and I think a few others have all reduced the size of national monuments. Whether or not a president can actually eliminate a national monument, I think that'll be up to the courts, although there was a study from the Pacific Legal Foundation from John Yoo and Todd Gaziano that suggested the president does have the constitutional authority to revoke a national monument designation. But ultimately, I do think this lies with Congress. I think they should do something similar to what they did with Wyoming back in 1943 and what the 81st Congress recognized in 1950. And that gives Wyoming a say in national monuments in that state. And I think if you did that for places like Utah or Maine, and if they accept that designation, then you're getting more input from the state and local leaders. In Utah, you have the entire congressional delegation who opposes Bear's Ears.
Back to Mark Squillace at the University of Colorado Law School. The president says, let's give the power to control these lands back to the states and the people where it belongs. What's the issue here with regard to state and local ownership as opposed to federal ownership?
Well, the simple argument is simply that these are federal public lands and they are enjoyed by millions of people all over the country, not simply the people locally in those states. And these lands, over many, many years, have become so important to our recreational needs and to protecting and preserving our cultural needs. You know, the last couple of years, we've set new records for visitation at our national parks, and many of the national monuments are later so prized by the people and by the members of Congress that these are designated as national parks. Some of our most famous national parks began as national monuments, and we're likely to see this continue. The Grand Canyon began as a national monument. Mount Olympus, which is now Olympic National Park, began as a national monument. Zion began as a national monument. So many of these places started as monuments because the president had the foresight to recognize their importance for the long-term health and welfare of the public. And if we were to turn these things over to the states, there's a risk that these would get lost to the broader public, which so values these resources.
Nick Loris, do you buy that argument at all?
I don't, because I do think the states and the county commissioners and the people that live there understand the benefits that tourism and recreation brings to their local economies. And I think the western states understand better than anyone else, especially better than the federal government, that these lands need to be protected for the future. But the problem is what has happened with the Antiquities Act is the act was to direct the president to limit the designation to the smallest area compatible with proper care and management of the objects, those archaeological objects, to be protected. And instead, what we've seen is just huge amounts of land, millions of acres in some instances, put off limits. And I don't think that actually is going to result in the best care and proper management of these lands, because it's just biting off so much for the federal government to maintain when they've already got a $12 billion backlog in the amount of land that they're taking care of now. So I think you have better incentives aligned when you put the proper care in the hands of the states and the county commissioners who know, I think, what's better for this land to protect it for the future.
Sharon Buccino, back to you with the NRDC. You said that all of us should value these lands and the preservation of these lands. But people really know about Beer's Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante? And isn't one of the reasons that the Native American tribes want to maintain their monument status because they want to encourage tourism and recreation and be able to make some money off it?
Yes, and I think coming back to the idea of the secrecy that we started with is really important and responsive to your question. You know, these are public lands, and it's not just that people should enjoy them. People do enjoy them and value them, and that's why people from across the country, millions of comments that went into the review period from across the country, from across party lines, urged Zinke to keep them as they were and to manage and protect them. They're public lands. It should be a public process, and it's an affront to democracy that these that the recommendations were not released.
Nicholas Loris, you wrote somewhat scathingly about the sort of sentimentality involved in people's desire to maintain these lands as they are. Do you feel that that's behind the large number of people who responded to this rather than the actual intention of, in some way, enjoying the lands that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a combination of both. I mean, I think there are so many different designations of land that when you talk about a national monument designation, it's easy for people to not really know or think about Bear's Ears, but they may be thinking about something like a national park, like a Grand Canyon or Yosemite, something that they're familiar with. And when you have companies like Patagonia running ads that we're going to be, you know, drilling in those areas, I think it creates a lot of misinformation about what the Antiquities Act actually does, what these designations actually mean. And so for me, it's about making sure those people who are most impacted by these designations, not, you know, people and lawyers trying to get mass comments submitted in places like Washington, D.C. and New York City that flood the comments box with basically cookie-cutter comments, but talking to the people who actually live there and are impacted by these designations. That's what really matters at the heart of this discussion.
Now, Mark Squillace, you're a lawyer, but do you think that the threats have been exaggerated?
Well, let me sort of respond to some of Nick's comments in this way. I think history proves that the local community doesn't always see through the future needs for those communities. And I think one of the best examples has to do with the Jackson Hole National Monument, which was designated by Franklin Roosevelt. It is now basically the biggest part of the Grand Teton National Park. When it was designated, it created an outcry in Wyoming. Indeed, it's what led to the amendment that Nick talked about that precludes any new monuments in Wyoming. And in protest of that monument, Cliff Hansen, who was a county commissioner at the time and later became a U.S. senator from Wyoming, he drove a protest cattle drive through the new monument and generated a lot of negative press for what was done. But what's interesting about that example, and it is not the only example, many years later, Cliff Hansen, Al Simpson, and many others who opposed that monument agreed that they had made a mistake, that in hindsight it was the best thing that ever happened to Teton County. And I think if you talk to them privately, I think they regret that you can't designate any new monuments in Wyoming, because there certainly is land in Wyoming that is worthy of that kind of protection. I think you could probably find the same kind of sentiment playing out now in the Grand Staircase Escalante area. The towns of Escalante and Boulder have seen a kind of economic resurgence that sort of passed them over before the monument was designated. And I think many of the businesses in those communities now recognize the important value that monument has contributed to the local economy.
Earlier we heard that some monuments have in fact been reduced or eliminated by Presidents Eisenhower, Taft, Truman, Coolidge, Mark Squillace. How did that happen?
Well, it happened, I think, in part at least because no one challenged them in court. So we don't really have a judicial decision explaining whether or not these presidents had that authority. There were a couple of really egregious reductions. The most egregious, I would say, was the Mount Olympus National Monument, designated originally by Teddy Roosevelt just a couple days before he left office, over 600,000 acres. And in 1915, Woodrow Wilson took out more than 300,000 acres of that monument. It's now Olympic National Park. It now contains over 1 million acres, so a lot of that land ended up back in the park. But that certainly was the most egregious example of a reduction that was made, never challenged in court. It was controversial, but never challenged in court. So we really don't know how the courts might construe the authority under the Antiquities Act.
Sharon Buccino, we don't know yet what the Trump administration is going to do, but if, in fact, it does decide to try to reduce or eliminate some of these monuments, are you at the National Resources Defense Council going into court?
We are, and there are a number of other people that will be as well, including the tribes related to Bears Ears, defending Bears Ears. And it's important to keep focused on the extent. One thing we heard in the rumors that circulated yesterday was that while there might not be a rescission or a elimination of monuments, there could be changes in the boundaries or the uses. And in our view, anything that's done that is inconsistent and conflicts with the proclamation creating these monuments is unlawful, and we will challenge it in court.
Nick Loras, with the Heritage Foundation, you said this ought to be taken up by the Congress. Is there any chance of that, or will there now have to be a long period of court battles first?
Well, it's difficult to see any type of reform coming from Congress, especially as divisive as it is. There has been legislation introduced to both repeal the Antiquities Act or to reform it to allow for states and congressional authority or approval for any designation, but getting that 60-vote threshold in the Senate is going to be awfully difficult. And in some instances, this does enjoy bipartisan support, the Antiquities Act. And so seeing some type of legislative reform, while you know we see it as preferable, is probably a long shot.
What do you think is going to happen in court then? Will this be a long, dragged-out battle?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think any designation or reduction or elimination, although it doesn't sound like there will be any elimination, but who knows, since we haven't seen the report, I certainly think it'll be a drawn-out legal battle, I think, as will most environmental decisions that the Trump administration makes.
So, Mark Squillaci, back to you. Are we really talking about something then that is not going to be resolved for a very long time, whether it goes into court or whether the Congress actually gets around to it?
Well, it's hard to know, but I think that the court cases will likely take several years to play themselves fully out. It depends on how many decisions the president decides to make. I'm guessing all of them, or most of them at least, will be challenged in court. They may be in different courts, and so we may end up with some conflicts among the courts that will have to be resolved by the higher courts and maybe even the U.S. Supreme Court. So it certainly could take a while to play out. I guess, though, I would like to sound a note of agreement with Nick about the role of Congress. It does seem to me that, and I don't think anybody disagrees, that Congress does have a role to play. Congress can modify or change or increase the size of any of these national monuments, as it has often done. I mentioned earlier that the Congress has often designated many of these monuments as national parks. It's very common. It's likely to continue to happen going forward. Indeed, the state of Utah, which is leading the fight against these monuments, touts its what they call their Mighty Five national parks in southern Utah. Four of those Mighty Five began as national monuments and were later designated as national parks by the Congress. And so I think the Congress perhaps can play a role, should play a role. I agree with Nick, though, that there is a fair amount of bipartisan support for protecting these lands because they're enjoyed by so many people.
And Sharon Buccino with the NRDC, will there be, as this battle goes on, more publicity, do you think, for Bear's Ears in the Grand Staircase Escalante? And will that be good or bad for the lands themselves?
Well, I think more and more people are seeing what is in the public lands and waters that belong to them all, to all of us. And again, I would come back to the key point in terms of the responsibility that Zinke and Trump have to all of us to do more than do nothing. And they need to put the time and money into preserving what's so special, what we look to these lands. They're really part of the American identity, who we are as people, what we share as a country, and that's why this issue has become so visible and so controversial, because there's so much at stake.
Okay, thank you all for being on this program. Sharon Buccino is again with the National Resources Defense Council. She's director of the Land and Wildlife Program. Nick Loris is with the Heritage Foundation. Is a Heritage Foundation fellow in Energy and Environmental Policy. Mark Squillaci is a professor of natural resources law, University of Colorado Law School, and our earlier guest was Daryl Fears, environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you all once again for being on our show today. Have there been sonic attacks on American diplomats in Havana? More on that in a moment on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, we're on here with today's talking point. Two Cuban diplomats have been expelled from the United States in response to unexplained physical symptoms suffered by American diplomats who live in Havana. They reside in compounds owned by the Cuban government. The State Department will not confirm the report by the Associated Press that they were subject to a covert sonic weapon. Ann Guerin is reporting the story for The Washington Post. Hi, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, it's good to be here.
There's a common fantasy that people are being zapped with rays of some kind or sonic weapons of another kind. It's pretty unusual to hear a serious conversation about the possibility of a covert sonic weapon causing physical symptoms. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it does evoke sci-fi movies and tin hat conspiracies of all sorts. But U.S. officials I've spoken to and who have talked to other news outlets have been pretty explicit that they believe something happened to these Americans serving in Havana and living in these Cuban government-owned compounds. They're just not sure exactly what the suite of symptoms suffered by Americans starting in December of last year were quite different in some cases, one from another, and hard to pin down. Some people didn't report them right away. Some people, when they reported them, didn't report them in the same place. So it took a little while for the U.S. to start to think that they were related and that they were the result of deliberate action by someone.
What are they? What are the symptoms?
They range from hearing loss, mild to somewhat more than mild, not profound, not utter deafness, but some measure of hearing loss that has persisted for some people. Headaches, nausea, dizziness, a number of sort of neurological things, although, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I haven't seen any of these people myself or seen the medical records, so it's hard to say exactly, you know, how close to brain damage these things get, but certainly symptoms that show that their brains were affected and their hearing.
Is this just since the diplomatic overture to Cuba by President Obama?
It is. It's all fairly recent. Again, the first symptoms were reported in December of 2016, well after 2 years after the announcement of that opening, and well after the former U.S. mission there had been converted into an embassy, and more Americans had gone to Cuba to staff it. And so it's also, if you think about it, at an odd time diplomatically, the expectation had been, of course, that Hillary Clinton would win and this diplomatic opening to Cuba would be continued, perhaps expanded, but certainly not retracted. And then, of course, Trump won in a surprise to the Cubans as well as everyone else. So the Americans who were working there with some uncertainty as to what would happen next, given how critical Trump had been of Cuba and of the diplomatic opening as a candidate.
I understand that some Canadian diplomats have had similar problems.
Yes, actually, the Canadian government was the first to confirm the hearing loss was among the symptoms, and they said 2 weeks ago that at least one of their diplomats had suffered hearing loss while serving in Havana at the same time. It wasn't very long after that U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson confirmed that hearing loss was among the symptoms. We and others had reported that, but the U.S. government wasn't confirming it up until after the Canadians did. They were merely saying that there were a variety of unexplained symptoms. And I will say that the U.S. government has been careful not to directly blame the Cuban government for this, and to say that while two Cuban diplomats were expelled from the U.S. In response, that doesn't mean that the U.S. is saying explicitly that the Cuban government was responsible for targeting Americans, rather that the Cuban government failed to live up to its obligation to protect them.
Okay, so the FBI, the State Department, and others are investigating this. Do they know about the possibility of eavesdropping technology that might, in fact, have this kind of reaction?
Yeah, that is one of the leading theories, that some form of electronic eavesdropping went awry and had unintended consequences. That is, at this point, for me, that is merely a theory. I know it's one that the government is looking at, but we don't have an indication yet that they've narrowed it to that.
What are the other theories?
Well, the AP reported that it was a sonic weapon. My reporting did not say the same thing. U.S. officials I spoke with talked about a device or an action, but they wouldn't call it a weapon.
A device or an action as opposed to a weapon. Why would they want to use a weapon? What's the theory behind that?
Well, no one can figure out a good one. It certainly would be out of keeping with the way the Cuban government has behaved toward foreign diplomats, Americans in particular, for a long time. Americans serving in Havana have been subject to intense surveillance and scrutiny and harassment, but never physical violence. That is extremely unusual. And for a number of people, 16 at least, the State Department said yesterday, to have suffered physical harm while serving there, it is both new and sort of a real head scratcher. Why would the Cuban government want to do that intentionally? What purpose would it serve? It clearly would put them on the hook.
Are there theories that it might be somebody else or something else?
Yeah, there are a number of other theories. One is that it could be Russian technology at work here, and that the Russians were either deliberately targeting Americans or applying a surveillance technique under Cuban okay that harmed Americans. Again, that is a theory, not something that I've reported. We've reported at the Post, but it is something that certainly people have raised as a possibility, given how closely those two governments and their security and surveillance services have worked together in the past.
Well, once again, it would be you must imagine that the FBI and the State Department and other agencies are not themselves innocent of conducting surveillance. So maybe they have devices and they know what might go wrong.
Well, right. I mean, the right people in the U.S. government are no doubt looking at this. Some people who have some experience with related matters.
Not knowledgeable observers, as we call them sometimes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So we don't know yet. You say that they have now confirmed 16, though, Americans have been affected this way.
Yes, that's quite a large number. I mean, there are only 40-some Americans who work there, so,
okay.
in full diplomatic jobs. They have families with them, too.
Ann Guerin, national politics correspondent for The Washington Post. Nice to talk with you again. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
To the Point, produced this week by Katie Cooper, Yael Evan Orr, Luke Vanderplug, Devin Schwartz, and Gideon Brower. Our technical directors are Mark Newport and Joel Stein. Our managing producer, Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.